Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese. Every fortnight, we post interviews with philosophers about their ideas as elaborated in their newly published books. Today's interview is with Alva Noe, professor of philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley, about his new book, Varieties of Presence, just released from Harvard University Press. What do we experience when we look at an object, say a tomato? A traditional view holds that we have or entertain an internal picture or representation of the tomato, and moreover that this internal picture is of the surface of the tomato, what's in our visual field. It does not include, for example, the side of the tomato that is hidden from view. This general view of experience has been critically scrutinized for some time by numerous scientists and philosophers, Noe among them. In earlier books, Noe has defended the idea that our experiences of the world are grounded in practical knowledge of how things can be manipulated, how they're available to us for use, and how skilled we are in using them. According to his inactive view of perception, Noe argues that the hidden side of the tomato, for example, is also in our experience of it. It is, in his words, present as absent. In his new book, Noe elaborates further on the inactive view to explain the nature of presence and the nature of access, of how the world shows up to us in experience, and how the way it shows up depends upon our modes of access to it. Let's turn to the interview. Hi, Alva.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm really excited to talk about your new book, Varieties of Presence. And this book, as many of our listeners will recognize, you know, follows two other books that you've written along the same topic of, you know, generally the nature of experience, of conscious experience. The first being Action and Perception, which appeared in 2004, and then Out of Our Heads, which appeared in 2009. So it's a interest of yours that traces back for a long time. So maybe you could start us off by giving us some background on generally on how you came to write this book, how you came to philosophy perhaps, and then how you came to focus your philosophical interests in this particular area of philosophy.
That's a great question. Thank you. Well, Action and Perception was my first book, and I published it, you know, almost 10 years after graduate school, after finishing my PhD in 1995. My PhD was also on perception. But when I left graduate school, I got very interested in cognitive science. I've been interested in it in a sort of a vague way, but I sort of started to get interested in cognitive science around the time when it was becoming more common for academic philosophers, for people who are really part of a philosophical community, to realize that a dialogue on equal footing with people working in psychology labs and neuroscience labs and robotics labs could be really a fruitful way to go forward. So my first job was actually a postdoc in Dan Dennett's Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. And in a way, I mean, that year was just a crash course in what was going on in contemporary cognitive science. And it was very inspiring. And I made a lot of sort of friends in the sort of philosophy / cognitive science community there. And almost had a whole sort of second, like a second PhD, like a practical PhD. I guess that's what a postdoc is really supposed to be. In any case, I came into that year convinced that action was in some fundamental way primary for understanding the human mind. But I didn't yet really know exactly how to move forward. There was one major figure in American psychology or in the history of cognitive science, J.J. Gibson, who'd sort of developed this idea. But I was really kind of moving forward on my own and not quite sure how best to move forward. To make a long story short, I started a series of collaborations with the psychologist Kevin O'Regan and with the philosopher Evan Thompson and with Dennett himself. And I developed a view which in Action and Perception I called the inactive view, using a term that Francisco Varela had used, where I argued that perceiving really needed to be understood as a kind of activity, and that this distinction between perception as something that happens sort of inside us and action as something that happens outside of us is problematic. And the book Action in Perception is a sort of systematic development of this idea, arguing that the quality and content of perceptual states can be understood in this way, and moreover that this has big implications for how we think about ourselves and what we are. I didn't really fully follow those up in the book. And my second book was really a follow-up on those implications for thinking about sort of the nature of the human being and the nature of the organism. The second book is called Out of Our Heads, and the subtitle is Why You Are Not Your Brain and Other Lessons from the Biology of Consciousness. And so what I really tried to argue is that there were good reasons, philosophical reasons, but also empirical reasons for rejecting a certain kind of brain reductionism. If we want to understand perception, if we want to understand consciousness, we really need to look at the active life of a living animal as it's situated in an environment, and as it's situated in an environment that includes other people. And so that book has a kind of a negative argument that attempts to find consciousness in the brain will fail. Looking for consciousness in the brain, I argued, was kind of like looking for the value of money on the paper it's printed on. It's just the wrong place to look. You need to expand and increase our conception of the terms in which we want to explain consciousness in order to come up with a better explanation. And we need to include the non-brain world, the body, and our dynamic interactions with the environment. And so that was the topic of that book. It was very much an engagement with neuroscience, but it also had a positive view, which I guess I've already stated. It's this sort of dynamic world involving view. Interestingly, I wrote that book deliberately trying to reach a non-philosophy specialist audience. I wrote it with people who were interested in the question and who may be educated and motivated to really take a stand on the issues, but who were not necessarily part of a philosophical community or even really part of an established cognitive science community. I wanted, you know, people in business and people in different far-flung fields of you know, medicine and neurology and cognitive science to be able to get into these issues. Sadly, one consequence of that is that it's been a little bit neglected in the philosophical community, but it is a widely read book, and that was really important. So if you think of Action and Perception as sort of laying the floor, so Out of Our Heads was sort of one fulfillment of the aims of Action and Perception. But there was a second issue that arose in Action and Perception, which was a whole set of issues about the nature of what I call presence, which I'm sure we can talk about.
Yeah.
And varieties of presence sort of started out life as papers that I wrote engaging with issues that were arising out of the more philosophical aspects of Action and Perception, is really an attempt to deal with this other side of the issues. So I sort of think of Action and Perception as like the parent node, uh-huh. and, And these two books are sort of sister notes, exploring different ways of developing the project in action and perception. And I've now got a very different project.
So that's a good segue into my first question about the book itself. Is this phenomenon of presence? You describe it as how the world shows up to us, and also as the basic phenomenon in the domain of the mental, and also as what is at stake in disputes over intentionality, and what's at heart in the problem of consciousness. So, could you first start us off by saying a word about what you mean by presence?
Well, presence really has two aspects. And I try to use ordinary language, non-technical language, to characterize it, but I end up then using that ordinary language in a fairly nuanced and technical sounding way. But the first of the thought is that the world itself, other people, things, tables, chairs, the ground we're sitting on, standing on, the air around us, the sounds we hear, that all of this enjoys a certain presence in our thought, in our perceptual experience, in our imagination. And that's what I mean by saying it shows up for us. We have a sense of its presence to us. You know, the sound of my voice to the listeners of this broadcast, the floor under our feet, these things are there for us. They show up. And that's the first fundamental aspect of what I call presence. And the second aspect of presence is that we show up. You know, here we are, here you are, Carrie, here I am, in this place, in this environment, situated in this world. And it seems to me that presence, in a way, is the sort of most all-encompassing and sort of intuitively plausible phenomenon for really capturing the basic features of our mental lives. So this is a book about, and in a way, the main idea of the book, you know, very simply put, is that presence isn't something that comes for free. It's not something that's sort of automatic or given. It's something that we actually achieve.
So yeah, you analyze presence or explain it in terms of what you call availability or accessibility, and that the character of presence is determined by as you put it, what we do to bring the world to hand. So maybe you could say something about that, about the differences in accessibility and how that affects our presence.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Carrie. You're obviously a really careful reader of the book. That's right. My thought is that many of the puzzles that we face about presence have to do with the fact that we've tried to analyze it. And when I say we, I mean really the great philosophical tradition that most of us are practicing within, or cognitive science, which in many ways is really just a footnote to that great philosophical tradition. Namely, we tend to think of presence as a matter of re-presence or representation. It's about something that happens in the head. So most writings on this topic, whether they call it this or whether they call it something else, are committed to sort of a family of isms. They're committed to internalism. After all, these representations are built up in our brains or in our minds. They're committed usually to a sort of intellectualism, the idea that the main work of the cognitive system is to compute or calculate or hypothesize or in some sense generate a model of what's going on around us on the basis of what reaches our sensory surfaces. The view tends to be individualistic. We tell a story about how this happens that really depends just on what's going on inside each of us. Each of us, in a sense, is the locus of the generation of our own experience, of our own sense of the world around us. So, I've argued in this book and elsewhere that the representationalism, the internalism, the intellectualism, and the individualism are all kind of problematic and don't work. I'll just give a sort of example. Take a simple visual case. You know, what shows up from visual experience. And again, I'm speaking in very general terms, but I think these will suffice to make the point. The traditional view, and the traditional view is alive and well all around us, the traditional view is that, well, the world projects to the retina, and then the seeing happens in the brain. The brain builds up a picture, a representation, a model of the world around us. So what I would suggest is that we notice two interesting things. The first is that in the visual domain, we experience much more than projects to the eyes. And that might sound kind of strange, but if you actually stop to reflect on what seeing is like, it becomes clear that, for example, when we see things, we see their hidden parts. Or not exactly see their hidden parts because they're hidden, but we have a visual sense of their presence. We have a sense of their presence in the visual modality. For example, to use an example that, like many philosophers, I've used a lot, you know, you look at a tomato, and you have a visual sense of the presence of the parts of the tomato that you can't see, the back of the tomato. Or you look at a room that's full of clutter and detail, and for example, maybe many people. And while it's obvious that you don't simultaneously look at every little element of the detail, you don't simultaneously focus on everything. Some things are in the center of attention, and some are in the background, and some are on the periphery, and some are maybe not even noticed at all. Nevertheless, you have right now, when you're looking, you have a sense of the presence of all of it. You have a sense of, it's not as though there are gaps in your visual field. You have this rich sense of it all. So, or to even give a more sort of interesting, profound example, when you look at another person, for example, quite beyond the fact that the person doesn't show up just as a mere surface, they usually show up precisely as a person. That is, not just as a physical thing, but as a person, and maybe even as, you know, as a woman, or maybe even as a police officer. So, and of course, police officerhood is not something that strikes the retina. So my thought is that we experience much more. We experience the presence in vision of much more than projects into the eyes. And then the second point is that not only do we experience more than what projects to the eyes, we don't experience everything that projects into the eyes. So we can fail to notice all sorts of things going on around us, even though they're perfectly in view and even though they're perfectly interesting, relevant, and important to us. And one domain where this has been very closely studied by psychologists is regarding the phenomenon of change blindness. In change blindness, if there's a distractor, when a change occurs, very often we won't notice the change. And it's astonishing. People are usually flabbergasted that they failed to notice, you know, a change in who they were talking to.
Right.
When they were distracted. Actually, in that example, I'm slightly assimilating change blindness and inattentional blindness, which are interestingly different phenomena. But for my present purpose, it doesn't matter. My point is, and I, forgive me, please, if I'm giving too long-winded answers to your questions, but my point is that I would argue that actually projecting into the retina is neither necessary nor sufficient for showing up in our visual consciousness, for being visually present. So I believe that we need really a very, very radically new way of thinking about what presence to vision is than representation in the brain as a result of projection into the eyes. And the proposal that I make is that presence, and I need to say this before you stop me, mm-hmm. is that presence is availability. And so that then applies to these examples. So right now, it's true the back of the tomato is out of view. But right now, I stand, even though the tomato is in front of me, in a relationship to the back of the tomato, such that by simple movements I can bring it into view. And similarly to the cluttered environment, I may be looking at the person right in front of me, but right now I have a sense of the presence of the person on the periphery of my visual field. And I think that consists precisely in the fact that I right now have access to that person at the periphery of the visual field. Now, this is meant to be an idea which is not just offered as a kind of brute hypothesis. Mm-hmm. The claim is meant to have phenomenological plausibility to it. And so what I argue in Varieties of Presence is that really, you know, if you reflect on it, if you sort of do the phenomenology, if you, what we can appreciate is that really the basic modality of the world's presence in consciousness, whether in vision, whether in hearing, whether in thought, the basic modality of the world's presence is its availability. And then to the many different ways in which the world shows up in our experience. For example, it's different for it to show up in hearing and for it to show up in sight. It's different to see something and different to think about something. That those differences correspond essentially to the different ways in which access is or would be achieved.
Well, let me just press on the anti-representationalist aspect of this. You know, sort of the negative claim there, because it wasn't clear to me when I was reading the book how anti-representationalist it needed to be. So, for example, clearly, I mean, it would seem that, you know, something is being stored. I mean, I'll just use that as a hopefully neutral term, from previous experiences with tomatoes and so forth, in terms of our manipulation of them, our access to them through various sensory modalities. And that information is being utilized in my current experience of the tomato. And it would seem that that is, it would seem consistent with your claims that information from past experience is somehow, you know, part of our current experience, but it's also something that is, you know, in some sense, in the head. Would you find that sort of a explanation or response, you know, entirely against your project?
No, that's very, very acute observation to make. Let me try to see if I can satisfy you and clarify the position. You know, the view is not that we're just empty heads. We're like, you know, like we're
right.
like an empty garbage can. I mean, it's an empty garbage can with these magical powers. No, it is a view that appeals in all sorts of ways to knowledge and to the role that knowledge plays in our lives. One of the points about the idea that perceptual presence is a matter of access is that, as was already implicit in what I said, the basis of access, its very foundation, is the possession and exercise of skill, or of the ability, for instance, of the knowledge that of both the ability to move one's body in relation to the environment so as to see more, but also one's implicit understanding that one has that ability. So both of those kinds of sort of first and second order knowledge play a very important role in the view. Now, there's some technical questions we could go into. I said first order knowledge, second order knowledge. Is it really two orders of knowledge? Is skill? Can by some suitable notion of implicit practical understanding, can we flatten that? But in any case, it's clearly important that the perceiver has the kind of know-how, or if you like, the kind of knowledge, or the kind of skill, or the kind of practical ability, or the kind of understanding that enables them to achieve access, and that's necessary for perceptual consciousness. And if you want to say if you want to call that represented, I don't quibble with that. But there's a number of further, that even seems important. But there's some important points to be made about that. The first is, what that knowledge and what that skill and what that access, what that knowledge, that skill, call it what you want to call it, is doing, mm-hmm. in my view, its function for the system, for the organism, for the conscious being, is to enable access. They are skills of access. They are abilities to do something. Like, you can think of them metaphorically as like calipers with which we can literally pick something up that you couldn't pick up without the calipers, because maybe it was too far away, or too hot to touch. So these are literally giving us ways of latching onto things. They are not themselves representations of that which they are, if you like, used to make contact with. And what we experience are not representations in our head. What we experience are the things around us that we can achieve contact with thanks to these capacities that we have. So if you want to say that the capacities are represented, fine. But what's important is that the world is not represented. And we don't need to think of ourselves as the traditional view does, generating a kind of a model. And then it's the model that is the content of what we see and what we experience. Now, there's one other point I'd like to make, which is directly relevant, and that is that you quite rightly point out that our perceptual experience of tomatoes in part depends on our knowledge of what tomatoes are, presumably our past experience of tomatoes. And you might think therefore, the concept tomato is entering into this achievement of perceptual contact with tomatoes.
Oh.
And I think I have two things I want to say about that. The first is that I think that the visual sense of the presence of a tomato in one's environment outstrips what can be explained just by appeal to the knowledge that there is a tomato there, or to the application of the tomato concept, or the belief that there is a tomato there. That is, the belief will give you, the concept will give you something like the cognitive thought that there's a tomato there, but there's a distinct qualitative visual character to the way in which even the unseen occluded portions of the tomato show up, that I think need to be explained by reference to much more low-grained, not really conceptual sensory motor skills, like a real understanding about how movements of one's body would change one's relationship and give rise to new sensory information. So that while I do think that the conceptual role is important, I don't think it is alone sufficient to explain the visual qualities that we're interested in understanding. That's the first point about this appeal to the tomato concept. And then the second point is that, as I argue in the new book, in ways that kind of go beyond what I said in Action and Perception, I want to say that there's no sharp or principled division between the conceptual and the merely sensory motor. Or to put it differently, that actually is something I said in Action and Perception, but to put it differently in a way I didn't put it there, there really is not a fundamental difference between sort of perception and thought. That is, the distinction between perception and thought breaks down. They're just different ways, that is, they're ways of exploring the environment, deploying different kinds of skills of access, sometimes conceptual, sometimes more bodily, sensory, motor.
So would it be correct? I mean, one of the ideas that came to me as I was reading was that this was, in an odd way, a very intellectual, intellectualist view, because of the reliance on understanding, in order to explain, experience. One of the things, yeah, so.
Yes, I mean, let me just stop you right there.
But then
please,
you,
yeah.
So one of the things that I thought was, well, I mean, you, okay, so here's a very, very crude way of thinking of it. You might think of experience in terms of some sort of understanding, which seems like an intellectual move, but then understanding itself is interpreted in terms of, you know, actual, you know, skill in manipulating things. So it seems to go inward, but it goes back outward again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You've understood the view perfectly. I would reject the view. I would reject the epithet intellectualist. Although maybe it's just wordplay. Maybe in the right context, I should warmly embrace that. In Action and Perception, I think of the view. I describe the view as Kantian. You know, intuitions about concepts are blind. And I view myself very much as resisting a kind of empiricism that thinks we have experiences that are sort of pre-understanding or pre-conceptual in terms of which we first frame our initial concepts. Instead, I offer the metaphor that we, you know, that understanding and perception arrive at the party together, and they work hand in hand to enable us to bring the world into focus for perception and consciousness. But to directly meet your point, I think that the big problem with the way people have tended to thought about the intellect, or at least many people think about it, is as sort of sublimated and hyper-intellectualized. So one of the chapters of Varieties of Presence is on over-intellectualizing the intellect. And what I want to say is that once you realize that the intellect itself is a domain of skill, the intellect itself is a domain of expertise, the intellect itself is a domain of practical involvement with the world, that the recognition that our experiential lives are saturated with exercises of the intellect isn't threatening. I mean, here, there's two different foes. On the one hand, you have a kind of, I don't know, let's call this philosopher a Phrygian, who thinks that the only application of a concept is in a certain kind of judgment, mm-hmm. which is explicit, and there's strict criteria for whether it applies or not. So for this philosopher, to say that experience is conceptual really is to make it seem rigidly deliberative and intellectual. And I think actually many cognitive scientists do have sort of that view of what a concept is. And then on the other hand, you've got people who completely, because of that way of thinking about what concepts are, completely reject that concepts can play any role. And here I'm thinking sort of especially of people influenced by Heidegger and Bert Dreyfus's interpretation of Heidegger and existential phenomenology, who are really interested in arguing, know that there's a kind of preconceptual, grounded in habit, automatistic involvement that we have with the world around us, and there's just no place for concepts there. Any application of concepts or reasons in making sense of what people do when they're in their engaged mode of involvement with the world falsely intellectualizes it. And to them I say, no, you only say that because you're taking for granted this hyper-intellectualized view of the intellect that your foe has endorsed. Once you realize that the intellect itself is a domain of involvement and practical engagement, you don't need to say that. So well, one of, yes, yeah. Please.
No, go ahead if you to finish.
Well, I just wanted to say that I said before that I thought in some sense the breakdown, my view allows for a certain kind of breakdown between the cleavage of thought and perception.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think sometimes it makes sense to think of thought as a kind of extended perception, and sometimes it makes sense to think of perceiving something as a way of thinking about it. But the differences are always going to be real, but matters of degree. That is, the differences need to be described in relation to repertoires of skills that we have that are all at least potentially in play. So, you know, if you're an empiricist, you think that perception has this fundamental role. It's, you know, we start with that, and then you know, thought is this thing that comes later. If you're a sort of an idealist, you think it's all really just a matter of thinking and concepts and experience. You know, can never give you anything you haven't already thought. And what I want to suggest is that really the fundamental category for approaching the mind is the achievement of our presence in the world's presence. It's a matter of, therefore, on my analysis, a matter of access. And from that point of view, the distinction between perception and thought just become two different modalities of achieving access to the world that are different, but also have in common this basic formal feature that they are ways of achieving access to the world. And they differ from each other in the same sort of way that hearing and touch differ from each other, that it has modalities, not as somehow fundamentally different modes of cognition.
Well, I mean, all that has raised a number of different questions. I'm not sure which to continue with first, but let me just ask something about what you just ended with this idea of the distinct modalities. Another thought that came to me as I was reading was the idea that maybe one of the problems that we have in thinking about experience or the mind, cognition, perception is this idea that there are distinct modalities. So to give the example of the tomato, according to you, our conscious experience of the tomato includes the parts of the tomato that are actually, you know, hidden from retinal access, so to speak. But they're accessible, in some other modality, touch or smell or something like that. And that those aspects are also part of our experience. But a way to sort of say that is just to say that, you know, what we call visual experience isn't ever purely visual, that all of our modalities, or at least two or three, are involved in every experience, and that what's artificially distinguished are the modalities, the sense modalities, rather than certain, say, offline cognitive acts versus skillful, you know, interaction with the world.
Yeah, gosh, that's such a beautiful question, and it can be answered in so many different ways because it's such a big topic. I mean, my first thought is to kickstand and say, well, actually, I think, you know, there's all the difference in the world between seeing the color of the surface and touching the surface. And these are fundamental distinctions in the taxonomy of human perceptual consciousness, and they need to be explained. I mean, you know, feeling a surface is different from seeing its color. And one of the interesting facts that has led me to the work that I'm doing is that if you look at a chunk of brain tissue from the somatosensory cortex and look at a chunk of brain tissue from the visual cortex, you're going to be hard-pressed to find any difference between them. And if you look at them functioning, you're going to be hard-pressed to find anything that looks like a difference that would explain how those differences in experience are so great, just in terms of those neural states. Therefore, I argue, we need to look not at what's going on just in the brain alone, but look at the way in which what's going on in the brain alone is yoked to a dynamic of interaction with the environment. Now, so there, I really think that this kind of actionist, inactive sensory motor approach that I'm trying to develop really wants to explain a genuine and non-gainsayable fact about human consciousness, you know, that there are modal differences. Now, having said that, I start to think that there is a profound sense in which you may be right, that talk about individual modalities is a huge abstraction. So I talked about color and texture, but once you start to notice that most perception isn't standing back looking at something and meditating on the character of your seeing, but is rather, you know, engaged, active, doing things, all our senses are active, and they are not active by giving you little atoms of consciousness, but we are sort of using them as we engage with the world. And it may in fact be that both phenomenologically and neurologically, and that is to say, and sort of in terms of the correct psychological taxonomy, that maybe the boundaries between them are much less significant than we thought. And you might be exactly right. I mean, there are now theories that are taken very seriously in the world of perceptual neuroscience, which suggest that, in a way, it's a mistake to think that visual cortex, the striate cortex, the occipital lobe, is actually distinctively visual. That its actual function is a certain kind of it can be characterized in different ways, but maybe one way to put it would be the processing of information about fine detail. And so that it's not surprising that blind readers of Braille use that part of the brain to do that.
Right.
And there are many examples where these very crude applications of sensory function to different parts of the brain may really correspond to metamodal structures that, that aren't so simple. So, so this is really an open field for thinking and research. I just came back from a meeting, in Germany whose topic was, synesthesia. Mm-hmm. And sensory substitution and thinking precisely about the limits of the modality idea.
So let me pursue a related issue that you mentioned, the idea of engagement or as I would like to ask about disengagement. One of the motivations for the whatever representational view you want to take, whether it's, you know, actual pictures in the head or something less intellectualized, the motivations for such views, which as you know do, you know, continue. I mean, there's still a very strong stream within cognitive science, which is looking at what goes on, you know, sort of internally. The reasons for positing these things is because we do so much of at least a certain amount of cognition offline. We can, you know, imagine manipulating tomatoes as well as experience them. So to what extent would it be correct to say that your argument is that that access or availability is a foundational move, but that once you have learned how to access things, then you are able to go offline with maybe, I don't know if you want to call them representations or something internal that doesn't require, you know, access, but is similar to it in certain ways and dependent upon it. I mean, are you making a foundationalist claim about the skill, or are you saying there's just not that much going on inside?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's as clear as I wanted it to be.
Yeah, that's a hard question for me.
Well, let me put it in a briefer way. How do you explain, given your emphasis on access and skill, how do you explain offline cognition?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that my view commits me to is the recognition that there's that offline, our offline mental life, to use your phrase, couldn't be just like our online mental life. The claim is not foundationalist in the sense that I'm arguing that we acquire the cognitive machinery we need in interaction with the world, and then we can go ahead and in a secondary way apply it offline. Mm-hmm. The claim is that experience in its full-blown sense is really something that happens in a dynamic of, in a temporally extended dynamic of exchange with the world around us. So the world is part of the story. And you couldn't do what you're doing to make your contribution to experience in the world's absence, just as you couldn't move your feet and legs in exactly the way that you would if you were hiking, but in the absence of the earth, which is guiding your movements. The thought is really that what we call experience is constitutively dependent on the world's contribution to the experience. So that's what seeing is, that's what experience is. I argue in varieties of presence that really even thinking needs to be understood that way too. But there, the structures that one is navigating and that one is hiking over, so to speak, are of a much more abstract nature. They are sociolinguistic norms and books and other sorts of repositories of information about things in encyclopedias and Google and the internet and so on. But that even in thought, what we're doing is we're making contact with things by dint of our abilities and the way in which our abilities are actualized and enabled by the surrounding environment. So now you might want to call thinking itself offline. And if that's the thought, then I guess what I want to say is that no, even thinking isn't really offline. It sort of looks like it's offline because you're just sitting there,
right?
And you're at home. Mm-hmm. But I want to say that thinking is only made possible, you know, thinking about Aristotle, thinking about Britney Spears, thinking about Angela Merkel, are only made possible by our situation in relation to a world around us. I mean, this is an idea that in many ways is the same idea that has been developed by the great externalists about content, Putnam, Kripke, Gareth Evans, and others. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to extend that into this whole framework for thinking about experience. But look, you may say, okay, that's all fine and dandy. Let's say it works for thinking. But sure, there is something which is offline, like imagination, or what about even dreaming?
Right. Or anytime we think about something to which we don't or cannot have access.
Well, one of the interesting things... This is so complicated. It's so difficult to be. I really need to take time to talk about it systematically.
Yeah.
But to which we don't or can't have access. Well, one reason why we might not have access to something is that it doesn't exist. Traditional approaches to intentionality have sort of viewed it as sort of a hallmark of the intentional objects or the mental states that it's not a requirement on them that they exist.
Right.
And the view about this that I take in varieties of presence is that we should really say about this that there's a difference between having access to something and merely seeming to have access to it. And that you can't have access to what doesn't exist. One of the conditions of access is its existence. And if I want to analyze presence to thought or presence to mind in terms of access, then I need to bite the bullet and grant that we can't think about what doesn't exist. And that is the position I'd like to defend. What makes it... I still then owe some sort of an explanation of what it is that makes it seem as if we have access to something when we don't. And the answer is actually, I think, kind of easy. The answer is right there, all around us. Well, you know, in the case of you're thinking about somebody who doesn't exist, you're just not, you are making use of all those same structural resources available to you, but there's nobody at the end of it. And so you can, you're climbing over that web of information, and you think you're going to find the pot of gold at the end, but you don't. But there's nothing mysterious about that. It's not as though, how could you possibly have stood in that relationship to this thing that doesn't exist? Well, what you were doing was you were taking for granted a geography that we have and a sense of the lay of the land that we all have, and we're sort of making a mistake. And
And somebody might respond to me, but wait a second. No, that can't be right. The fundamental thing about thinking is that, you know, your thought pertains to and is directed to this object. And if it doesn't exist, you know, then you have a false belief. Or, but the thing there I want to say is, look, if you're thinking about something that doesn't exist, that is to say, if it seems to you as if you're thinking about something when you're not, I want to say that's a difference that makes a difference in the way what you seem to yourself to be thinking out seems to show up for you. It's a difference that makes a qualitative difference. For example, the example I give in the book is, you know, take thinking about a religious figure, like a figure in a biblical story.
Yeah, the example I was thinking of was, thinking about the second coming of Christ or something like that.
Well, I don't want to use Christ as an example because
that's fine. Yeah.
For Christian believers,
yeah,
he's so central.
Right.
But take just a more marginal character in a biblical story. I can't even think of a good one. Or even take
Jonah.
The point is that, you know, maybe there is nobody answering. Maybe it turns out Jonah didn't exist.
Right.
I would say that, you know, finding out that Jonah didn't exist would be radically different in significance than, say, finding out that Barack Obama doesn't exist. Like, we almost can't even imagine how radically different the world would need to be from the way it is for it to be possible that Barack might not exist. But Jonah, you know, he's so far away in our conceptual sociolinguistic space that finding out that he didn't exist would really be just about, would give us some insight into the quality of the presence he seems to us to have. It's very difficult for me to state this super clearly because the idea is so complicated. I tried to get it in the book, but it's still a work in progress. But the thought is that the reason why the book is called Varieties of Presence is that it's not as though something is present simply all or nothing. There's different ways in which things can be present just as envisioned. Something can be really, really far away, but you can just make it out. And that's a kind of presence, but it's so different from the presence of, you know, the book you're holding in your hand or the person sitting next to you. And why should we think that our relationship to the thing which is really, really far away is just like our relation to the person sitting next to us? And I want to say the same is true about thought. Things can be so far away that we barely think about them, even though we think we do, or they can be so far away that we think we are thinking about them when we're not, and we should allow for that possibility. But the really hard case for what you're talking about is dreaming, because in dreaming it seems that you actually have full-blown conscious states that depend not on the world around you, but just on what's going on in your head. And if you can have that, why couldn't you have the whole shebang?
Yeah.
And that, to me, that really is the hardest question. And I have answers to it. But I'm also sensitive to the fact that, my answers don't settle the question. They don't silence this objector. And the first point I want to make is that I think we can, what I would want to insist on is that the sort of the Cartesian skeptic who worries that everything we might be experiencing is a dream makes an assumption, a substantive, if you like, ontological assumption, as to be contrasted with the epistemological worry about whether we can know, which is that any experience that you might have would be something that you could dream that you're having.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's reasons to question that empirically. That is, I think that my hypothesis is that the way we achieve the world's presence is by online access to it. So that if you remove the world, that there's simply going to be a limit to the degree of presence that we can achieve. And I think that, in fact, that is actually borne out by empirical investigations of the content of dreams. So, for example, Stephen LaBerge, in his laboratory where they work with lucid dreamers, has found that in a lucid dream, or in any dream, if a dreamer reads a sign of complicated text and then in the dream looks away and looks back at the sign, mm-hmm. it never says the same thing twice. That is, the dream world isn't anchored in anything except what the dreamer says is there, so to speak, so that it's simply not possible to preserve detail across scenes in a dream. We need the world to do that. We need our content to be anchored in the world. And so my first thought is to try to suggest that we need to take seriously the fact that there's certain kinds of content of our experiential lives that really depend on the world's contribution and the contribution that is made available thanks to our situation in and relation to the world around us. And that we just can't have that offline. And so then the thought would be that if we can't have some stuff offline, it really is going to be just as a kind of residual of what we can do online as a sort of a knock-on effect. And then I would make the claim, and this is a strictly empirical claim, right? Mm-hmm. I could be wrong about this. I would make the claim that if a person were then to be cut off from the world, that the resources of their mental lives, the things that were still sort of residually available to them in memory and imagination, would gradually diminish.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was actually one of the things that I inferred from the book. Although one of the things that you do say that I thought was rather surprising is that we can't have novel experiences. And I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate that claim a little bit, because that was also somewhat counterintuitive, at least to me.
Yeah. The thought is that in a way it kind of goes back to a sort of Platonic paradox of the Meno sort of worry that in order to look for something you already need to know what you're looking for, and if you already know what you're looking for, then why bother? And the thought is that we have is that what enables us to bring the world into focus is our ability to achieve access. And access depends on skills. And anything that was genuinely outstripped our sensory motor or conceptual expectations would in effect be something we couldn't latch onto, couldn't get a grip on. And so it wouldn't show up for us. So this is a view that I sort of came to it when writing Action and Perception, but it came out in an interesting way. I'm trying to think of exactly how this argument got started, but I had an interesting exchange with Andy Clark about sort of the turn on just this question. Actually, I'm not sure that's really quite to the point. The point is really just what I've said so far. So I'm trying to. There's a lot of balls in the air with this one, and I'm trying to figure out exactly the best place to begin. But the basic thought is let me give an example. You know, take a case of reading.
Mm-hmm.
well, when you read, you have this very sophisticated conceptual, linguistic, ocular motor set of skills that allows you to make sense of any text which is given to you. That is to say, it lets you treat any text which is given to you as, if you like, something that you understand, something that you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you're given a text in a foreign language or in a foreign alphabet, you really can't even see it. It just looks like gibberish or like gobbledygook, or, you know, you couldn't copy it. You couldn't really describe it accurately. You can't even really see it. But once you learn the language, all of a sudden, it becomes easy to see. So it's almost as if the knowledge makes new things old, and in making them old and familiar, it makes them perceptible. And this then raises the interesting question of how do we ever have new experiences? Because obviously we do, and there is such a thing as learning. And I think that one place where we see this, where all of us, each of us can actually have this experience, is in the domain of art. You know, if you go hear some music in a style that's unfamiliar to you, sometimes it's, and then somebody asks you, you know, what was it like? Or, you know, can you hum a melody? Or, sometimes it's really hard to say anything at all. It's hard to even perceive it. It just was kind of somehow below the threshold of being recognizably, identifiably something.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you listen more, as you get familiar with it, as you gain certain expectations about what it's doing, all of a sudden, when you do that, it becomes rock solid clear, rock solid perceptible. So for me, it's this beautiful tension where we do seem to be able, through active engagement with the novel, to enable the novel to be experienced. We see this when we get to know styles of art that were previously unfamiliar. But what's remarkable is that this process whereby we find ourselves able to bring the novel into focus are kind of processes whereby we make the novel familiar. And so that when we finally describe what is given to us in perception, it's something that has, you know, it's more like the character of an old pair of blue jeans than it is like the character of something genuinely strange and marvelous.
We've domesticated in some
way. Yes. Yeah.
We're running out of time, which is unfortunate because there were a number of interesting responses you give to discussions by Sean Kelly and Jason Stanley and Timothy Williamson and other figures that are discussing similar issues, and we're not going to get to that. But I do at least want to ask what you are working on now. What your next project is?
Thanks very much. The new book is about art, and it's called Strange Tools, and it's really about art and human nature. You know, I ask, what is art? What does art tell us about ourselves? Why does art matter to us so much? Why does art matter to us so much? And the book has a sort of a positive dimension and also has a negative dimension. The negative dimension is I'm very skeptical of the current trend which seeks to try to understand art in neurological or neuroscientific terms.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very fashionable movement called neuroaesthetics,
yes,
which tries to use the resources of neuroscience to understand art. On the other hand, I'm very much committed to the idea that we ought to try to look at art in relation to our biology. So I try in the book to positively develop a way of thinking about human biology so that we can make a nice, informative interplay between art and human experience. So that's the new book. It's still, I think, a little ways off from being finished.
Okay. Well, I look forward to reading that book too. So,
thank you so much, Claire.
Yeah. Thank you. And good luck.
Great, okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Al Vannoy, professor of philosophy at University of California at Berkeley, about his new book, Varieties of Presence, just out from Harvard University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.